The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to begin by taking a look at who's really challenging the official 9/11 report. I did 11-hour special thus far with experts giving information to us that was easily the most compelling reasons why we should have a new independent look and review of the information surrounding events of 9/11. This is just a follow-up to that. Then, why is it that the United States government refuses to reveal its secret interpretation of the Patriot Act? Who's asking? The New York Times sues them to get that information. Canada is urged to arrest and prosecute George W. Bush. Who's asking? Amnesty International. In Japan, new maps reveals contamination of radiation all over the island. And what is the biggest single potential crisis in the world today? Derivatives. How much? $600 trillion. It's a time bomb that's set to explode. And finally, an in-depth answer from Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield was condemned as a medical fraud that he used the British healthcare system to his advantage. Dr. Wakefield will give a uninterrupted, complete rebuttal to those who've attacked him. I suggest you listen to this carefully, especially if you appreciate understanding the freedom of speech issues. Let's begin. This is from, on behalf of Ian Henschel, who we've had on this program. This is the latest as of today. The CIA is under more pressure as FBI agent adds to revelations on sinister role in 9/11 attack. I'll quote this. The BBC Radio's 4 Influential Today program interviewed the FBI 9/11 whistleblower Ali Soufan. Soufan told listeners that he was handed a dossier by a CIA officer 2 days after 9/11, which contained information the FBI had been demanding from the CIA for months prior to 9/11 attacks. He said that the attacks would have turned out differently if the FBI was given the information that they needed. His testimony has been backed by Richard Clark, White House anti-terror chief at the time, who has little doubt that the 9/11 hijackers could have been rounded up, arrested, and has stated that the CIA also made a decision to withhold the vital news from him, too. Known al-Qaeda operatives were active in the U.S. In the absence of orders to the contrary from Bush, Rice, and Cheney, the CIA was breaking the law in its decision, according to Clark, not to cooperate with the FBI. At the time of 9/11, the media were told that the U.S. had lost interest in Afghanistan and that al-Qaeda was a stunningly efficient, well-resourced organization. No mention was made of the 80-strong Osama bin Laden unit operating under cover from other parts of the CIA and from separate premises. It has since emerged that in the months before 9/11, the CIA was monitoring al-Qaeda's main communications hub in Yemen, as well as the 2000 Malaysian summit when the 9/11 attacks were discussed. Today, this FBI agent estimated that al-Qaeda had around 400 operatives. He might have added that plenty of them were informants for various intelligence services. the new revelations upon upset 10 years of an official 9/11 narrative inspired largely by figures in the CIA, that the attack succeeded due to incompetence and lost messages within the FBI. This explanation was emphasized in the BBC's Conspiracy Files programs, since condemned as one-sided and in breach of the BBC's obligation to exercise impartiality in its programming. The BBC Trust is currently stonewalling requests to review the issue and meet human rights lawyer Paul Warburton and others campaigning for the full disclosure. Currently, CIA's covert assets and others in the mainstream media are developing a new narrative. The CIA was somehow fooled by elements of the Saudi intelligence services sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. This narrative makes little sense and contradicts statements made in the years before 9/11 that the CIA did not trust Saudi intelligence. Meanwhile, on the internet, CIA-linked sites have appeared promoting the idea that Israel's Mossad was behind the 9/11 attacks. Officially, the CIA has issued a blanket denial of Clark and Soufan's revelations. One of the CIA officers named as part of the plot to withhold information was Kofor Black. Is credited in the insider accounts as the man who persuaded President Bush to introduce torture post 9/11. Black soon left the CIA to be a principal in the Iraq mercenary company Blackwater. He is currently an advisor to Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney. A recent book by Kevin Fenton, Disconnecting the Dots, analyzes the paper trail in meticulous detail and shows how a small group of people in the CIA, then top secret Osama bin Laden's unit, plotted to stop the FBI from getting information, set false trails that to some extent fooled the investigators of the 9/11 Commission and made false statements to investigators and could not recall key details from any vital meetings. 9/11 commissioners have since said that they did not believe CIA boss George Tenet was a reliable witness after he repeatedly denied meeting Bush in the weeks before 9/11, a statement which turned out to be false. Tenet had been flown down to Texas twice. Bush told the local media he had been having long and very important discussions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff at much the same time. Now, that's some of the latest. Now, what is important is for those who have challenge the official version of events 9/11. People are told there is no one credible who has directly attacked the 9/11 Commission. These are right-wing and left-wing loons. These are people who have no credibility. Then I will bring you people who have impeccable credibility and let you decide for yourself. No one in the mainstream media, not a single person on Fox or MSNBC, any of the networks, has put this information together, yet it's all a matter of public record. Let us begin. And by the way, we are trying to establish a video feed, and that should come up very shortly. You can watch the program as well. Senator Mac Cleland, a former member of the 9/11 Commission, said, and everything I'm telling you are verbatim quotes, "I, as a member of the 9/11 Commission, cannot look any American in the eye. It is a national scandal. This White House wants to cover up 9/11. Senator Mark Dayton, member of the Senate Committee on Armed Services and Homeland Security, "NORAD lied to the American people. They lied to Congress and they lied to your 9/11 Commission. The most gross incompetence and dereliction of responsibility and negligence." Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, who was vice chairman of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, "The 9/11 investigations that have been done so far as more or less cover-up and no real explanation." Congressman Kurt Weldon, "The 9/11 Commission, there's something very sinister going on here, something deeply and desperately wrong. This involved what is right now the covering up of information that led to the deaths of 3,000 people. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, member of the Armed Services Committee, "The House Commission ran up against obstruction by the administration and non-cooperation from government agencies. the Arizona missions immediately jumped out at us. Director of the FBI, Louis Freeh. The 9/11 Commission findings raises serious challenges to the Commission's credibility, and if the facts prove out, might just render the Commission historically insignificant itself. Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Paul Craig Roberts, Ph.D. Distinguished national and international scientists and scholars present massive evidence that the 9/11 Commission report is a hoax, and that the 9/11 terrorist attack has been manipulated to serve a power agenda in the Middle East. We know that it is strictly impossible for any building, much less steel column buildings, to pancake at free fall speed. Therefore, it is non-controversial fact that the official explanation of the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings is false. Assistant Secretary of Housing, Catherine Austin Fitz. Regarding 9/11, the official story could not have possibly happened. It is not possible. It is not operationally feasible. The commission was a whitewash. U.S. Army Intelligence Officer and Federal Prosecutor and Office of Special Investigations, U.S. Department of Justice, John Loftus. The information provided by European intelligence services prior to 9/11 was so extensive that it is no longer possible for either the CIA or FBI to assert a defense of incompetence. Foreign Service Officer George Kenney. I cannot believe, much as I might like to, the standard account of 9/11. Foreign Service Officer J. Michael Springman. 15 of the 19 people who allegedly flew airplanes into buildings in the United States got their visas from the same CIA consulate in Jeddah. Deputy Attorney General, State of Pennsylvania, Philip Berg. The official story of what actually took place on 9/11 is a lie. Major General of the Army, Commanding General of the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, Albert Stubblebean. I look at the hole in the Pentagon, and I look at the size of an airplane that was supposed to have hit the Pentagon, and I said, the plane does not fit into that hole. So what did hit the Pentagon? Colonel Ronald Ray, U.S. Marine Corps, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, Deputy Director of Field Operations for the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Center. I'm astounded that the conspiracy theory advanced by the administration could in fact be true, and the evidence does not seem to suggest that's accurate. Colonel Robert Bauman, U.S. Air Force Director of Advanced Space Programs, Ph.D. in Aeronautics and Nuclear Engineering. The official 9/11 story is impossible. There is a cover-up. High levels of our government don't want us to know what happened. Highly placed individuals in the administration, Dick Cheney, the very kindest thing we can say about George Bush, is high treason and conspiracy to commit murder. Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force, Aircraft Accident Investigator. I never witnessed nor ever heard of an aircraft loss where the wreckage was accessible that prevented investigators from finding enough hard evidence to possibly identify the make, model, and specific registration number of the aircraft, and in most cases the precise cause of the accident. The government alleges that four wide-body airliners crashed on the morning of September 11, 2001, resulting in the deaths of more than 3,000 human beings, yet not one piece of hard aircraft evidence has been produced in an attempt to possibly identify any of the four aircraft. On the contrary, it seems only that all potential evidence was deliberately kept hidden from view, with all the evidence readily available at the Pentagon crash site. Any unbiased, rational investigator would only conclude that a Boeing 757 did not fly into the Pentagon as alleged. Similarly, with all the evidence available at the Pennsylvania crash site, it was most doubtful that a passenger airliner caused the obvious hole in the ground, and certainly not the Boeing 757 as alleged, the most heinous conspiracy in our country's history. Major Doug Roque. Regarding the impact at the Pentagon on 9/11, when you look at the damage, it was obviously a missile. Captain Russ Wittenberg, U.S. Air Force fighter pilot, commercial pilot on 9 different types of airplanes, had previously flown Flight 93, which impacted in Pennsylvania, and Flight 175, the second plane to hit the World Trade Center. The government story they handed us about 9/11 is total BS, plain and simple. Regarding Flight 77, the airplane could not have flown at those speeds which they said it did without going into what they call a high-speed stall. The airplane won't go that fast if you start pulling those high-G maneuvers at those bank angles. The vehicle that hit the Pentagon was not Flight 77. Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kawasaki, U.S. Air Force, Office of the Secretary of Defense, staff of the Director of the National Security Agency. It is as a scientist that I have the most trouble with the official government conspiracy theory, mainly because it does not satisfy the rules of probability or physics. The collapse of the World Trade Center buildings clearly violate the laws of probability and physics. There was a dearth of visible debris on the relatively unmarked Pentagon, where I stood only minutes after the impact. Beyond this strange absence of airline debris, there was no sign of the kind of damage one would expect from the impact of a large airliner. This visible evidence or lack thereof may also have been apparent to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who, in an unfortunate slip of the tongue, referred to the aircraft that slammed in the Pentagon as a missile. I saw nothing of significance at the point of impact. No airplane metal, no cargo debris was blowing on the lawn in front of the damaged building as smoke billowed from within the Pentagon. All of us staring at the Pentagon that morning were indeed looking for such debris, but what we expected was not evident. The same is true with regard to the damage we expected. But I did see that there was not what we were told that we would see. Rather, the facade had a rather small hole, no larger than 20 feet in diameter. All this facade later collapsed. It remained standing for about 20 to 30 minutes, with the roof remaining relatively straight. The scene, in short, was not what I would have expected from a strike by a large jetliner. It was, however, exactly what one would have expected if a missile had struck the Pentagon. Senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School, Barbara Honinger. The U.S. military, not al-Qaeda, had the sustained access weeks before 9/11 to also plant controlled demolition charges throughout the superstructures, the World Trade Center 1 and 2 and 7 buildings, which brought down all three buildings on 9/11. A U.S. military plane, not one piloted by al-Qaeda, performed the highly skilled, high-speed 270-degree dive towards the Pentagon that air traffic controllers on 9/11 were sure was a military plane as they watched it on their screens. Only a military aircraft, not a civilian plane, flown by al-Qaeda would have given off the friendly signal needed to disable the Pentagon's anti-aircraft missile batteries as it approached the building. Only the U.S. military, not al-Qaeda, had the ability to break all of its standard operating procedures to paralyze its own emergency response system. Captain Gregory Ziegler, U.S. Army, U.S. Army Intelligence Officer. I knew from September 18, 2001, that the official story about 9/11 was false. Anomalies poured in rapidly, the hijackers' names appearing in none of the published flight passenger lists. BBC reports of stolen identities of the alleged hijackers or the alleged hijackers being found alive. The obvious demolitions, the World Trade Center 1 and 2 and 7, not hit by an airline. The lack of identifiable Boeing 757 wreckage at the Pentagon. Captain Eric May, U.S. Army Intelligence. I view the 9/11 event as a matter that implies either 1. A passive participation by the Bush White House through a deliberate stand-down, or 2. Active execution of a plot by rogue elements of government, starting with the White House itself, and in creating a spectacular destruction that would lead the U.S. into an invasion of the Middle East. Former chairman, the National Intelligence Estimate, CIA, responsible for preparing the daily briefing to the President of the United States, U.S. Army Intelligence Officer Raymond McGovern. I think at simplest terms, there's a cover-up. The 9/11 report is a joke. just as Hitler in 1933 cynically exploited the burning of the Parliament building, the Reichstag, this is exactly what our president did in exploiting 9/11, making a war of aggression on a country that he knew had nothing to do with 9/11. That's certainly an impeachable offense, but compelling evidence for an even more disturbing conclusion, that the 9/11 attacks were themselves orchestrated by this administration precisely so they could be used to exploit the situation. National Intelligence Officer and Director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis, William Christensen. There is persuasive evidence that the events of September did not unfold as the Bush administration and the 9/11 Commission would have us believe. An airliner almost certainly did not hit the Pentagon. The North and South Towers of the World Trade Center almost certainly did not collapse and fall to Earth because hijacked aircraft hit them. And all this was totally an inside job. I have since decided that at least some of the elements in this U.S. government had contributed in some way or other to causing 9/11 to happen, or at least allowed it to happen. The reasons that the two towers in New York actually collapsed and fell all at the way to the ground was controlled explosions rather than just being hit by two airliners. All of the characteristics of this demolition show that they almost had to have been controlled explosions. I think you almost have to look at the 9/11 Commission report as a joke and not a serious piece of analysis at all. It's a monstrous crime. U.S. Marine Corps Intelligence Officer, Case Officer of the CIA, Robert David Steele. I am forced to conclude that there is sufficient evidence to indict Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and others. This is, without question, the most important modern reference on state-sponsored terrorism, and also the reference that most pointedly suggests that select rogue elements within the U.S. government, most likely led by Dick Cheney, with the assistance of George Tenet, Buzzy Krongord, and others close to the Wall Street gangs, are the most guilty of state-sponsored terrorism. I'm absolutely certain that the World Trade Center 7 building was brought down by controlled demolitions, and that as far as I'm concerned means that this case has not been properly investigated. There is no way that building could have come down without controlled demolition. CIA Case Officer, Specialist in the Middle East, Director of Operations, awarded the Career Intelligence Medal, Robert Beyer. Regarding the opinion there was an aspect of inside job to 9/11 within the U.S. government, there is that possibility. The evidence points to it. Counterterrorism expert in the Security Division of the Federal Aviation Administration, team leader of the FAA's Red Terrorism Team in the Federal Air Marshal Program, Coast Guard Officer Bogdan Dazkvigat. At worst, I think the 9/11 Commission is treacherous and hence treasonous. Minister of Justice, West Germany, Horst Simek. Terrorists could not have carried out such an operation with four hijacked planes without the support of a Secret Service. State Secretary, Federal Ministry of Defense, West Germany, Andrew von Bülow. The official story is so inadequate and far-fetched that there must be another one. This is unthinkable without years-long support from secret apparatuses of the state and industry. President of Italy, Francisco Cosna. 9/11 could not be accomplished without infiltrations in the radar and flight security personnel. And there are many others from around the world. And this is important because this comes from the 9/11 Commission itself, from its chairman, Thomas Keene, former governor of New Jersey. The FAA and NORAD officials advanced an account of 9/11 that was untrue. We to this day don't know why NORAD told us what they told us. It was just so far from the truth. Vice Chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Homeland Security Advising Council. We got started late. We had a very short time frame. We did not have enough money. We had a lot of people strongly opposed to what we did. We had a lot of trouble getting access to documents and to people. So there were all kinds of reasons we thought we were set up to fail. 9/11 Commissioner Timothy Romer, PhD, Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, that panel members so distrusted testimony from Pentagon officials that they referred their concerns to the Pentagon's Inspector General, we were extremely frustrated with the false statements we were getting. Senior Counsel, 9/11 Commission, John Farmer Jr., former Attorney General, New Jersey, former Commissioner of the State Commission on Investigations. Some staff members and commissioners of the September 11th panel concluded that Pentagon's initial story of how it reacted to the 9/11 terrorist attacks may have been part of a deliberate effort to mislead the commission and the public. I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public for 2 years, end quote. Therefore, for those individuals who state that 9/11 happened exactly as we were told and it was reported by the 9/11 Commission, you now have on the record verbatim statements from some of the highest ranking members of the Intelligence Committee, the FBI, the CIA, the 9/11 Commission itself and different departments, and long-term employees within our government, all of whom state that the official 9/11 report is wrong. Now, this today, a quick overview. Amnesty International today urged Canadian authorities to arrest and either prosecute or extradite former U.S. President George Bush for his role in torture ahead of his expected visit to Canada this month. Canada is required by its international obligations to arrest and prosecute former President George Bush given his responsibility for crimes under international law, including torture. Amnesty International submitted a memorandum to the Canadian authorities on September 21, 2011, outlining the case for his legal responsibility. The violations took place during the CIA's secret detention program between 2002 and 2009 and include torture and other cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment and enforced disappearances. While President George Bush authorized the use of a number of enhanced interrogation techniques against detainees held in secret U.S. programs. Therefore, let us see what happens. But now, groups are going after it. The New York Times sued the U.S. government and asked a simple question. Why aren't you telling us what your secret interpretation of the Patriot Act is? The government refused to tell them and then refused their request for information about why they are not telling the world about it. And finally, before we go to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, from Keith Fitzgerald, Chief Investment Strategist, derivatives, the $600 trillion time bomb that's set to explode. I'll quote this. Do you want to know the real reasons banks aren't lending? It's because risk of the $600 trillion derivatives market isn't evening out. To the contrary, it's growing increasingly concentrated among a select few banks, especially here in the United States. In 2009, five banks held 80% of derivatives in America. Now, just four banks hold 95.9% of U.S. derivatives, according to a report from the Office of Currency Comptroller. The four banks in question, JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs. Derivatives played a crucial role in bringing down the global economy, so you would think that the world's top policymakers would have reined these things in by now, but they haven't. Instead of attacking the problem, regulators had let it spiral out of control, and the result is a $600 trillion time bomb called the derivatives market. Think I'm exaggerating? The notional value of the world's derivatives actually is estimated at more than $600 trillion. Notional value, of course, is the total value of a leveraged position's assets. This distinction is necessary because when you're talking about leveraged assets like options and derivatives, a little bit of money can control a disproportionately large position that may be as much as 30 or sometimes 100 times greater than the investments that could be funded only in cash and instruments. The world's gross domestic product is about $65 trillion. That's roughly 10% of the worldwide value of the global derivatives market, according to The Economist. So there is literally not enough money on the planet. If every dollar, if every piece of currency on the planet, if all the gold on the planet were put into one pile, it would not be enough to backstop the banks trading these things that could run into trouble. Compounding the problem is the fact that nobody even knows if the 600 trillion figure is accurate, because specialized derivatives like credit default swaps that are now roiling the European markets remain unregulated and unaccounted for. To be fair, the Bank of International Settlements estimates the net notional value of uncollateralized derivatives risk is between 2 and 8 trillion, which is still a staggering amount of money, as well as beyond billions being talked about in Europe. Imagine the fallout from a $600 trillion explosion if several banks went down at once. It would eclipse the collapse of Lehman Brothers in no uncertain terms. A government default would panic already anxious investors, causing a run on several major European banks in an effort to recover their deposits. That would in turn cause several banks to literally run out of money and declare bankruptcy. Short-term borrowing costs would skyrocket and liquidity would evaporate. That would cause a ricochet across the Atlantic as the institutions themselves then panic and try to recover their own capital by withdrawing liquidity by any means possible. And that's why banks are hoarding cash instead of lending it. The major banks know there is no way they can collateralize the potential daisy chain failure that Greece represents. So they're doing everything they can to stockpile cash and keep their trading under wraps and away from public scrutiny. What really scares me, though, is that the banks think that this is an acceptable risk because the odds of a default are allegedly smaller than a 1 in 10,000. But haven't we heard that before? Now to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield, more than any other physician in the United States and England, has been condemned as a quack, as a fraud, as a charlatan. And he was not given an opportunity to defend himself in any major American media except this program. Earlier this year, I did a 3.5-hour special on Dr. Wakefield that you're welcome to listen to by going to Progressive Radio Network Archives. And you'll see this in-depth original investigative report, including a 1-hour debate I had with his primary attacker that you can hear in its full. Now Dr. Wakefield has an opportunity to address the challenges against him. And as you will see, though it is somewhat scientific, and you have to listen carefully, every single argument about Dr. Wakefield, he deconstructs, and he shows that the real problem is not what he and a group of independent scientists discovered when they looked at the health of some children who had gotten the MMR vaccine, but rather the vaccines themselves and covering up what could be a $1 trillion liability for the British government. So instead of doing the honest thing and taking the vaccine off the market permanently, they instead made Dr. Wakefield the fall guy.
In looking at this, we have to examine motive, and let's go right into the heart of this. Why did I end up in the particular position that I am in now? One was listening to the parents' story, another is this. This is Urabi AM9. Urabi AM9 is a strain of mumps vaccine that was developed in Osaka in Japan in 1967. It has never been used in this country, but it causes meningitis, and it is no longer in use in developed countries. This first arose in Canada in 1986, when the Urabi AM9 strain was incorporated into the combined measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. This was noted at Montreal Children's Hospital and confirmed by CSF analysis. The onset of this meningitis was between 19 and 26 days in these initial cases. That is important, and it's important because the clinical trials for the safety of MMR vaccine in England and elsewhere were limited to 21 days. And here we have an incubation period for a virus that's causing meningitis, which goes beyond that period. And what we now know from the product insert from SmithKline Beecham is that it is rare for this meningitis to appear before 30 days after administration, rendering, therefore, the safety trials totally inadequate. The equivalent in England of the Vaccine Advisory Committee over here is the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. They inquired about the risk of the adverse reactions to MMR when it was anticipated that this vaccine should be introduced to replace the single vaccine in the UK in 1988. And so as early as 1986, they were looking at the background. They inquired about the risk of adverse reactions to MMR, and it was stated that favorable results on safety have been reported both from Finland and the USA. Now, the important thing about this is that these two countries did not use an MMR containing the Urabi strain. They used MMR2 from Merck, and this contained the Gerald Lynn strain, which had never been associated in documented history with the onset of aseptic meningitis. However, not only but also it was felt that respectable data from other countries, those countries that I've just mentioned, would be acceptable to the UK's Committee on Safety and Medicines to approve the Urabi-containing MMR vaccine. It might be possible in this way to directly move directly toward product license stage, in other words, to bypass the usual clinical trials and go straight to the licensing of this untested product. 1988 was an important year in this process. In 1988, having been recognized that this vaccine was causing meningitis in Canada, it was withdrawn from Quebec. The vaccine was called Trivirix in Canada, but it was made by SmithKline Beecham. In June, the name was revised. Trivirix was then relabeled as Fluzarix. In July, Trivirix was withdrawn in Ontario for the very same reason, and later in July, the Fluzarix vaccine was licensed in the UK. This is against a background of a certain knowledge that this vaccine was causing problems, and one imagines that this is at least in part why the name needed to be changed. Beyond that, a senior regulator from the UK, Dr. Peter Fletcher, who has been a staunch advocate of vaccine safety, commented that Dr. Susan Wood of the Medicines Control Agency, urged SmithKline Beecham, SmithKline French, to conduct post-marketing surveillance. This vaccine was clearly dangerous, and therefore active post-marketing surveillance should undoubtedly have been conducted by the company and or the government, and yet no such research was ever done on any vaccine. So in summary, we have a high-risk vaccine, a vaccine that was known to be causing meningitis in children. Irrelevant safety data based upon studies of another MMR vaccine. Inadequate safety studies that did not even go to the incubation period of the mumps virus within the central nervous system. Shortcuts to approval, bypassing the necessary trials. Contrary advice, an expert had been invited in from Canada, where they'd had this experience with MMR, in order to advise them about the introduction of the Urabi-containing vaccine. He said, do not do it, and they ignored his advice. There was also ignorance of the advice to conduct post-marketing surveillance. There was a failure to warn anyone about the actual risks of meningitis with this vaccine, and as I said, no post-marketing surveillance to determine the actual risk of the vaccine. Problems started to arise when it was introduced in Japan. These names have been redacted from the JCVI minutes. Somebody was concerned about the possibility of the Japanese experience being published. So now in the peer-reviewed scientific literature, there was an effort to suppress the publication of data which might cause public alarm about a vaccine rather than informing. This process of cover-up then continued. Trivirix lost its license in Canada, followed by Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore. There was a worldwide withdrawal of Fluzarix by SmithKline Beecham, but there was no product recall. They did not wish to cause undue alarm. It was secretly withdrawn thereafter in Australia. So now we have, in addition to these failures, a clear evidence of a cover-up. Meningitis occurred at 100 times the predicted rate. When a study was done comparing active versus what was then passive surveillance, in other words, when they actually went and looked for cases of this disorder, they found that it was 100 times the predicted rate. In other words, passive surveillance for vaccine or any drug is a complete and utter waste of time. And in September 1992, 4 years after its introduction in the UK, it was suspended in the United Kingdom. Urgent action was required. It was withdrawn over the weekend, and Dr. David Salisbury, who was largely responsible for this whole process, went cap in hand to Merck to beg for the supplies of MMR to be made up. Why is this relevant? In 1996, Professor Sir David Hull was became part of the, he had been on the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. He then became the chairman later on, and he then became the advisor to the House of Commons Select Committee on Child Health Services. I, at that stage, had become involved in litigation related to a possible pending MMR class action litigation in the UK. I felt I had a moral and professional obligation to get involved, since when these children with autism with whom we were now dealing, when their parents became old, infirm, or died, then there was nothing for them, absolutely nothing. They were going to die on the street, and there was an epidemic of this particular problem. Someone had to do something if these children had been damaged by vaccines to compensate. However, Professor Sir David Hull, who had a clear conflict of interest with his role on the introduction of the Urabi-containing vaccine, and the years when it should have been monitored but wasn't, and its subsequent withdrawal and cover-up, felt it was his duty to inform the dean of my medical school, clandestinely, that I was involved in this vaccine litigation. In other words, what I was doing was a scientific study based upon a grant given by a government body, the Legal Aid Board, to determine whether the measles virus, the residue of the vaccine virus, was present in the intestine of these children. And these two, Dr. Professor Zuckerman is on the World Health Organization as an expert on hepatitis B vaccine, felt it was necessary to try and prevent this vaccine safety research. Why? Because, as Zuckerman said when he wrote to the British Medical Association to determine whether the work was ethical, clearly this could lead to a case against the government for damages. And yet the case that I was involved in was not against the government. It was apparently against the vaccine manufacturers. So where did this come from, a case against the government? In fact, Dr. Armstrong, chairman of the British Medical Association's Ethical Committee, wrote back to him and said not to conduct this research because it might embarrass the medical school or lead to a case in litigation against the government is not a sound moral footing. And he urged that the work should be done. In fact, Professor Zuckerman put that letter deep in the bottom of a drawer and it never emerged until the General Medical Council inquiry. Why? Why could it lead to a case against the government? On Newcastle Station in 1997, I met a whistleblower from the government who was in fact that doctor who'd been brought over from Canada to advise on the introduction of MMR in the UK, the one who said, do not do it, the one who said, you must have active surveillance. His name is Dr. Alistair Torres, and he told us about the prevailing attitude in the Department of Health at that time, which he said was bordering on the fascist. He was deeply concerned that many children had been badly damaged by this vaccine. They'd been discarded because they were the unacceptable face of a government policy, and that the vaccine had been introduced because it was a quarter the price of MMR2. They wanted to give the market to the home team, SmithKline Beecham, and it was a cheap vaccine. So the government, knowing this vaccine was unsafe, had put price before the safety of children, and he had disclosed all of this to me, not once, but twice. He called himself George at that stage. What had happened is that SmithKline Beecham, when this, it was proposed that they should have a lion's share of the market in the UK, said, we're not happy with this because we're having problems with this vaccine in Canada and elsewhere. Because the government so wanted this vaccine, presumably because of the price, they offered to indemnify SmithKline Beecham against damage caused. It is not certain that this indemnity was in any way legal or had ministerial approval. Pluserix, as I say, was cheaper. And in the JCVI minutes, this is confirmed as late as 1993, SmithKline Beecham continued to sell the Urabi strain vaccine without liability. This is something that David Salisbury has repeatedly denied. And yet here it is in the minutes for which he was personally responsible. By 1985, and this is just an interesting aside, by 1985, the monovalent Urabi AM9 vaccine had been given to about 5 million persons around the world, predominantly in Japan, but around the world. There had been no reports of meningitis with the single vaccine. It is only when it was combined into the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, a vaccine that was totally inadequately tested, that the appearance of this meningitis occurred. And I would suggest that this is a very good example of viral interference, leading to an unintended and unexpected outcome. You would have anticipated there would have been at least 2,500 cases of meningitis based upon the Japanese data, and yet there are none apparently in the literature. So is this an idiosyncratic response to MMR? And this was my principal concern, not anti-vaccine, not about protecting children from serious infectious diseases with safe vaccines, but an inadequately tested polyvalent viral vaccine which we know absolutely nothing about. The phenomenon of viral interference was known as early as the first trial of MMR in 1969, and yet it was discarded. It was completely rejected as being of any relevance, except that it altered seroconversion rates and therefore meant you had to juggle with the amounts of the vaccine in the particular, the virus in a particular vaccine to get the same seroconversion rate. The implications for safety were completely ignored. So what about the method? How do people deal with whistleblowers? How do you deal with people who raise concerns, who are conducting what appears to be valid safety research? This is a tried and tested method, but what we have here is a combined interest of the pharmaceutical industry and their profit margins and liability, and the government in a similar situation with policy and face-saving. We also have clearly Bill Gates now in the mix, as well as Bono, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the American Society, Academy of Pediatrics. Everybody's in the mix now. The first is to isolate from your colleagues, to discredit and to divide, as Louis XVI said, pour encourager les autres, to encourage the others. He would cut off the heads of every fifth one of his generals in order to encourage the others. The anatomy of fraud and the latest allegation from the British Medical Journal that this, the Lancet paper itself, was fraud. Let us look at that. This is the paper itself. It's a simple case series. 12 children who presented with this unique and interesting syndrome of developmental regression into a disorder which in many cases looked like autism, and gastrointestinal symptoms such as diarrhea, abdominal pain, which had never been investigated, which in these children had been largely ignored because diarrhea 12 times a day was to be expected in children with autism, or failure to thrive was to be expected, or a child doubled over in pain all day was expected in children with autism. No, it wasn't. No, it absolutely wasn't. And because these children had autism, they had largely been put to one side. Put them in a home, get over it, move on. No. These children were clearly sick and they needed help. And they needed help from the best pediatric gastroenterologist in the world, the founding father of pediatric gastroenterology, Professor John Walker Smith. And he was head of the team that led this investigation. And Deer says now, Wakefield has been branded by the British Medical Journal a fraudster. They described his work as an elaborate fraud. He also went through the results, manually altering test results and diagnoses and histories of the children so as to create the appearance that there was a link between MMR and autism. Let's look now at the medical records and see what actually happened. What we have in the UK in terms of the medical records from which we're able to construe a paper like this is the referral letter from the GP, the general practitioner or the paediatrician, saying, "Dear Professor Walker Smith, please would you see the following child who presents in the following way." That was based upon a distillation of his medical record, his clinic record, which we did not have access to. So we have a distillation of that in the GP record. We also had a red book. The red book in the UK is part of the National Health Service. Every child born, the mother is given a red book that they take home and they keep. And it's a documentation of the child's vaccination history, his developmental history. A nurse, a senior nurse called a health visitor, goes to the house on a regular basis to developmentally assess the child. So it is a prospective developmental record. It's very valuable, and it is what we used in this study. And we have, of course, Professor Walker Smith's clinical record from the Royal Free. So the distillation of these three went into the Lancet paper. Brian Deer, during the litigation, had access to the GP records, and he found a discordance in some cases between what was written here and what was in the paper. And therefore he labelled this as fraud. We did not have this document. We had these documents, and it was therefore based upon what we were told that went into the paper. How can it be fraud if we did not have the document in the first place? Falsification of disease. So I am blamed solely and singly from the 13 authors in this paper for falsifying a bowel disease in these children. What happens in the assessment in a tertiary referral centre of bowel biopsies? The biopsies go to the routine pathology laboratory. They're taken from the child, they're put in formalin, they're sent down to the routine pathology laboratory where they're assessed by a pathologist who may be an expert in nothing at all. He may be a generalist, or he may have a particular interest in breast cancer or brain tumors, but he is not a pediatric gastrointestinal pathologist. Professor Walker Smith and his team have an unparalleled experience of GI pathology in children. Every week of every year of his entire professional career, he has held what he called a clinico-pathological conference, where he and his team sit down with the pathologist and assess and reassess the pathological changes. And it was during this assessment process that he recognized that the duty pathologist was missing disease. So Professor Walker Smith, not content with his own opinion, then went to the senior GI pathologist in the hospital and asked him to blindly review the tissues from all the children with autism. This is Dr. Dillon. Dr. Dillon did this on a standard pro forma, as one would do in a research setting. And here is an example. Ascending colon, this is the no inflammation or no features of disease, mild, moderate, severe, and a total score here. And this is acute inflammation, chronic inflammation, and architectural changes associated with colitis. And at the bottom, there was a summary diagnosis. This is the way in which this work is done in a tertiary referral center. This is a blinded review. He knows nothing about the history or diagnosis in these children. And what he finds here is there is a severe chronic inflammation. Now, the importance of this particular record in child 9 of the Lancet 12 is that the duty pathologist had scored it as normal. And yet the expert comes and looks at it and says, no, in fact, this is disease. This is what went into the Lancet paper. And as Professor Walker Smith said at the General Medical Council, this was totally unrelated to Andy Wakefield. And yet I am accused of fraudulently generating this document. Brian Deer, knowing all of this, knowing about this process from at least 5 different sources, looked at the routine report and compared them to what was in the Lancet and found a discordance and called this fraud. He did that knowing that it had gone through this process of due diligence. That is fraud. Child 2, I just want to give an example of the history, how Brian Deer altered the history. This is what he said about child 2. Child was diagnosed with regressive autism, which according to the Lancet paper started 2 weeks after his jab. No, he wasn't. He was described as having a regressive developmental disorder. We did not use the term regressive autism as a diagnosis for any child. In the Lancet paper, it is not, and was not at the time, a recognized diagnostic status. We did not say that this regressive autism started 2 weeks after the jab. We said that his first behavioral symptom started 2 weeks after the jab. This is a clear distortion. However, this child's medical records, backed by numerous specialist assessments, which he fails to reference, said that his problems began 3 to 5 months later. This is what the clinical records from the Royal Free said, based upon which the paper was constructed. Child 2 started headbanging about 2 weeks after the MMR and hasn't looked right since. This was the child's psychiatrist who assessed him. Had his MMR immunization at 2 weeks. Following this, he'd started headbanging behavior and screaming through the night. In addition, we had Professor Walker Smith's independent assessment of these children, which was presented to the Wellcome Trust in 1996. I wish today to present some preliminary details concerning 7 children, all boys, who appear to have an enterocolitis and disintegrative disorder, which we thought at the time probably autism, following MMR. So there was a clear perception from this very senior physician at the time that this was intimately related in some way in these first 7 children to the MMR vaccine. Fraud. This was also done, as he said, to create the appearance that there was a link between MMR and autism. And this is the interval. What we discuss now is the interval between exposure to a possible environmental trigger and the onset of the disorder. He was able to obtain, somehow, from within the Royal Free, a draft copy of the paper. And as you know, these kinds of papers may go through 50 iterations before the final copy. What we said in that draft paper of August 1997 is onset of behavioral symptoms was associated by the parents with MMR vaccination in 9 of 12, with measles infection in 1 and otitis media in another. These are the 11 children for whom the parents cited a possible precipitating event, 11 children. When it was in those 11 children that this possible inciting event, precipitating event, was reported, and the average interval from exposure to first behavioral symptom was 14 days, with a range of 1 to 56 days. When we got to the final paper, we were specifically interested in an encephalopathy following the vaccine. And we wrote, onset of behavioral symptoms was associated by the parents with the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine in 8 of the 12 children. One mother had in fact read it in the newspaper, and that didn't count. And with the measles infection in one child and otitis media in another. In 8 children, the onset of behavioral problems had been linked by the parent or the child's physician with measles, mumps and rubella vaccination. 5 had had an early adverse reaction to the immunization. And in 3 cases, in these 8 children, these are 8 children now, not the 11, the average interval from exposure to first behavioral symptom was 6.3 days. Now, Brian Deer on his website wrote this. Average interval between reported MMR shot, this is a completely new criteria, and onset of behavioral symptoms, draft paper 1 to 56 days, final paper 1 to 14 days. These were 11 children, including one with otitis media and one with measles infection. It was not MMR vaccine. This is a different group. These are 8 children where the onset was following MMR. The conclusion is that Deer compared the intervals between 2 fundamentally and explicitly different groups of children while claiming that they were the same. And Dr. Godley had a presentation at the NIH, an invited presentation 2 or 3 weeks ago, deemed that this manipulation of the data by me was sufficient that I should undergo criminal prosecution. It's a measure of the diligence to which she applied herself in this particular case. And I'm afraid that Dr. Godley has not heard the last of that. So, in making their case, they had to change a finding of intestinal disease, that is colitis and or ileal lymphoid hyperplasia, in children presenting with a history of development, normal development, followed by loss of acquired skills, including language. They had to change this to their own criteria in order to construct an argument for fraud. A finding of non-specific colitis in children presenting with autism who regressed, whose symptoms of autism were first indicated within 14 days of MMR. That is not what we said at any stage. Okay, I want to just illustrate very briefly with reference to a couple of examples this fraud. This table really shows what Brian Deer set out in the BMJ. It wasn't actually in the BMJ, it was in Web Extra tables that were buried deep online. But here are his criteria, children 1 to 12. Blue is where he disagreed but did not allege fraud. Green is where he agreed with us. And red is those instances which he argued were fraudulent. 23 of them for the various children in domains regressive autism, non-specific colitis, and within days of MMR. Let's just look at some examples of those. Yes, here we have that child, MMR, headbanging, problems within 2 weeks of MMR. Brian Deer said they weren't. The answer is yes, they were within days of MMR, and therefore the child had all 3 features. And I can work through every single domain in this table to demonstrate the fallacy of Brian Deer's argument. Child number 7, he said of child number 7, at no stage, either before, during, or after this child's attendance at the Royal Free, was he diagnosed with autism. And this was not within days of MMR vaccine, his regression. This is Professor Walker Smith's referral letter. There does seem to be a clear relationship between symptomatology and MMR vaccine. He had the MMR rather later than usual at 21 months, and then within 24 hours he had a seizure-like episode and his behavior changed thereafter. The psychiatrist concurred with this. MMR at 20 months became quiet with a decrease in spontaneous language. Child 7 was diagnosed by Dr. Barilovitz, the psychiatrist, in contrast to what Brian Deer says, with somewhere between Asperger's and autism. However, technically, he could not have Asperger's because he had impairment in language. He had a language delay, therefore, by definition, he had autism rather than Asperger's. So, in contrast to what Brian Deer said, that he is not diagnosed either before, during, or after his attendance at the Royal Free with autism, he was diagnosed with autism. And so, yes, he had autism with regression, and yes, it was within onset. So, just another example of where we go. The other final thing to say is that it was argued by Brian Deer that there was no ethical approval for the research aspects of this work. The research was the detailed analysis by Dr. Dillon of the research biopsies. All of the rest was clinically indicated as deemed necessary by some very, very senior clinicians. Brian Deer, in his experience, determined that they were not clinically indicated, which is something quite alarming. During the process of making his complaint to the Royal Free, to the General Medical Council, he obtained somehow records of these children and other records from the Royal Free Hospital. It's an extraordinary violation of patient privacy, giving them to a journalist. He took these documents and he submitted them with his complaint to the General Medical Council. Or did he? No, he didn't. He kept certain documents behind which were highly relevant to the charges that he was alleging and to the material outcome of the case. And that is that there was an ethical approval for the work that was done in the Lancet paper. It was awarded the year before. It's called EPC 16295, and it is for research on intestinal biopsies. And there were 13 documents or so relating to this, which Brian Deer extracted from the documents that he gave to the General Medical Council because they ran contrary to his argument, and he did not disclose them. And there is a consent form in every child's records, the Lancet 12, that is pertinent to this ethical approval. That is a positive piece of evidence that they were investigated, they were researched according to that ethical approval. There was a complete absence of any consent form relating to a later ethical approval, which Brian Deer said we violated. And yet, sadly, when all of this evidence was presented to the General Medical Council, they dismissed it in a single sentence without any analysis whatsoever. And that is largely the basis of Professor Walker Smith's appeal at the moment. And this, I would suggest, is Brian Deer. This is an example of really perverting the course of justice in order to achieve.
That is Dr. Andrew Wakefield defending himself against the allegations from Brian Deer, who I debated for an hour on this program, and I had copies of the actual approval to do this investigation that Wakefield and the other 12 members of his team had. Brian Deer and others claimed that there was no ethical consideration. In other words, they didn't pass any board of ethics. Untrue. I had the actual original documents. So listen to that debate if you want to hear how I deconstruct Brian Deer's arguments. What does all this mean? What this means is that in the United States, we have refused to accept that there is any legitimate challenge to the safety and efficacy of any single or multiple vaccines. And yet repeatedly, when I have written in-depth, comprehensive, fully documented articles showing that what they claim they cannot prove, but what we claim we can. We're claiming that the cause of major illnesses being eradicated had nothing to do with any vaccine, that the illnesses were gone long before a vaccine was invented, the better public health, cleaner water, cleaner food, more food, stopping child labor. This is what caused these epidemics to stop, not the vaccines. But here's where you have to understand. If you can prove that the officials within government that approved these vaccines knew that there was a problem with them and allowed them to go forward in any case, and if you can prove that these vaccines were known not to be effective and to be dangerous, think of the litigation, think of the scandal against the agents involved, the agencies involved, the government in whole, think of the amount of money they would spend. This was also true in England. And that is the real story. So 13 members of a panel, including one of the most famous physicians, scientists in England, and yet one person was thrown to the wolves, and that was Andrew Wakefield. So that's it. Because they could not tolerate the fact that there could be an actual association between vaccines and autism on any level. But indeed, there was that evidence. I'm Gary Nall. One final thing, and then we're going to take a few moments. If you have questions or comments, you can share them. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. to share any of the thoughts on what you've heard thus far today in our program. And our final insight, this comes from Lucas Hickson from Global Research. Japan contamination maps, radiation is spreading. I'll quote this. 7 months after a triple meltdown at the coastal nuclear plant, as Japan is still trying to get a sense of the radioactive fallout, regulators, operators, and investors in the nuclear industry face the toughest daily battle in 30 years. Numerous hot spots well outside the 20K exclusion zone keep popping up. Elevated levels of radioactive cesium have been recently found more than 240 kilometers from the plant. Concerned residents who doubt the accuracy of the government's monitoring now perform their own test. Japan citizens' patriots show contamination problems accumulating. Recently updated contamination maps provided to Japanese citizens have shown that the contamination is spreading, but the government and TEPCO are still not releasing analysis of all the data required to ensure public safety. Most notably, a full analysis of radioactive isotopes released from the four crippled reactor buildings at Fukushima. A recent soil sample in Yokohama, analyzed earlier this week near Tokyo, found to contain strontium-90, an isotope that can accumulate in bones and cause cancer. According to a TBS report, the level of radioactive strontium was 195 becquerels, which is 95 becquerels per kilogram above the government standard. The strontium was found atop an apartment building in a measurement made by a private agency at the request of a resident and was not recorded in the regular monitoring done by the ward. Yokohama is about 250 kilometers from the Fukushima nuclear plant. This was the second finding in the area in the last month, following the announcement from the Yokohama government last month that it detected 40,200 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram of sediment collected from one part of a roadside ditch, easily exceeding the 5,000 BQ government benchmark. In the city of Funabashi, just north of Tokyo, officials said Thursday that a small part of a park in the city recorded elevated levels of radiation, about 500% higher than the highest levels previously detected in the city since nuclear accident. So what we have is we have hot spots showing up all over Japan. It's in the water, it's in the soil, it's in the food. And instead of being honest with the population and telling them the truth, and letting them know how much radiation they're going to be exposed to, they're lying about everything and covering it up. And in the future, there will be an epidemic of cancers and people dying because of this cover-up. I'm Gary Knoll. That's all the time we have. I want to thank you very much for listening. I'll look forward to sharing more on our next program.
Does she love me with all her heart? Should I worry?